is.
I don't eat no meat, no dairy.
There he is.
What about this overcrowded land? How much more do you from man? Can't you stand?
Silly Milton, these cows are for calves.
If not succulent, tasty or kind, it's dead for no reason.
Hello and welcome to The Species Barrier, where two vegan environmentalists question how we interact with the planet and the other animals who call it home, and explore that barrier in place which separates the human animal from other species. Coming up today, author and environmental activist Derek Jensen joins us to discuss his thoughts on the urgent need to dismantle industrialized society. Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus at Arizona University, says it's all too late anyway, and that imminent extinction is assured for humans perhaps as soon as 2030. John Stewart, who was ranked as the UK's number one environmental activist in the Independent newspaper, is back on the show. Last time he discussed the aviation industry, this time it is rapidly sprawling road networks. Also, NASA suggests industrial civilization may only have a few decades left. US scientists intervene on the urgent need to tackle human-caused climate change. As the Southeast braces itself for the construction of two new cities, Jonathan Porritt warns that environmental groups have a problem with population. And as environmentalist Al Gore confirms he plans to eat vegan for life, meat and dairy are suggested to be as dangerous for human health as cigarettes. The Fact of the Day will investigate how much soya is actually grown for human consumption. So we've just been away to Scarborough.
We've just been away to Scarborough, and in Scarborough there's a fantastic vegan cafe called Calf. All the funds go to an animal rescue, and it's 100% vegan. I thought the food was absolutely delicious. I don't know what you thought, Marcus.
Yes, it's a very high standard of food, and like you say, all the funding was going towards the animal sanctuary's work, so it was an opportunity to indulge a bit.
They're only open on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays until Easter. Then I believe they start opening in the week. But you can check them out on Facebook again.
We'll put a link to them in the show notes for this episode. We went for a walk on the local beach there, and obviously we were very dismayed by the amount of plastic waste that we found.
Yeah, being us and not able to let plastic go into the sea where it may harm other animals, we decided we found plastic bags, you didn't need to bring your own, and we did a clear up, maybe 200 metres if that, and we got two carrier bags full, and they were both overflowing.
Yeah, stuff that would have really caused harm to the animals who live in the ocean, such as turtles and so forth. They would have got wrapped up in this fishing wire, the plastic binding of six packs of beer and so on. It all ends up in the sea and they end up eating it or getting wrapped up in it. Also, once it breaks down, it becomes poisonous and toxic for the ocean. So getting the plastic off the beach before it's taken away by the tide and ending up in the sea, it seemed like a very important thing to do while we were walking stretch of beach. And as you just said there, you can always find plastic bags everywhere. We know that. You don't have to take your own.
Yeah, it's a real, real shame. We often find that when we're doing cleanup. So we go walk through an area that's quite, well, they need a cleanup. We'll always find many, many plastic bags. They're just awful. And I don't get why people still use them. You go to any supermarket, anywhere really, even your fruit and veg shop, and everyone's taking a plastic bag apart from us. And they look at you very strangely if you don't. But that's what happens to them. They get blown around. They end up in the sea. They end up in anywhere really. And they end up causing damage to wildlife.
Plastic isn't breaking down anytime soon, and it's no problem at all, is it, to just take your own bag with you when you go shopping. That's all it takes.
And even if you forget a bag, stick it in the trolley. Only buy as much as you can physically carry. If you're in a car, take the trolley to the car and put it in there, so you shouldn't be in a car. But generally, if I've forgotten a plastic bag, I'll just have to go back and come back into the shop again, or carry the stuff home in my arms.
Also concerned about the degradation of the natural world was Chris Packham and his Wild Night Out, which we saw at the LPAC. What did you think of that?
Yeah, this was amazing. Chris came did a free talk at Lincoln Performing Arts Centre. It was packed out. There must have been, I don't know, 500 people there. They gave away the tickets firstly to kids and college students, which I think is really quite good because Chris's message is really important for both my generation and the generation underneath me. You know, people who will be the ones who pick up the mess.
He was very aware that he was passing on a message and trying to inspire love of the natural world in these young children who turned out at the event. It was very beautiful in the photographs he was showing, but also very sad, and you could tell he was very exasperated with the fast decline of the natural world. We asked him in the question and answer session, like, why is he patron of Worldland Trust and Population Matters? And of course, Worldland Trust is a charity he's patron of and supports the protection of land. But Population Matters, he said, is arguably even more important a charity in what it does.
Yeah, basically Population Matters and their sister organisation Pop Offset work in countries to increase contraception availability, which is really important with a growing population. You know, people ought to have the choice. They ought to know that there is a choice to not have children or to, at the very least, be able to just have one child. Whereas in a lot of places, there is no contraception and therefore they have huge families.
He was very upset with how things actually are now with 7 billion humans, but obviously he's very concerned still about the projections of 10 billion, 11 billion. And he recommended the book 10 billion by Stephen Emmett, something that people could read and educate themselves on this topic further.
Definitely one we'd recommend, as well as the book The World Without Us.
It was also nice that when he was talking about soya clearing the Amazon along with cattle ranching, that he made clear that the soya production is grown to feed to farmed animals. It's not going towards human consumption in the vast majority of cases.
Yeah, and he also said that basically you're not going to be able to consume flesh very soon, especially beef, because of the huge environmental destruction it causes.
Yeah, he said enjoy it while you can because this isn't sustainable and you're not going to be able to consume environmentally harmful animal products much longer.
It's a shame, unfortunately, he still does consume dairy as far as we're aware, which also, as we know, is also hugely environmentally destructive as well as having huge ethical problems. But as an environmentalist, it doesn't really make any sense to consume dairy.
No, but on which topic? And there's still time for him yet, as Al Gore has shown us. We previously reported that former vice president and environmental campaigner Al Gore had been said to have gone vegan. He's now spoken about this in an interview with Medscape.com. Over a year ago, I changed my diet to a vegan diet, and I felt better, so I continued with it. Now, for many people, that choice is connected to environmental ethics and health issues, but I just wanted to try it and see what it was like. In a visceral way, I felt better, so I've continued with it, and I'm likely to continue it for the rest of my life.
And that makes total sense, because eating a diet heavy in meat and cheese may be as harmful for you as smoking a cigarette. That's according to new research. And the new study published in Cell Metabolism on March the 4th shows that middle-aged people who eat a diet high in animal proteins from meat, milk and cheese are more likely to die of cancer than someone who eats a low-protein diet. The research also showed that people who ate lots of meat and dairy were more likely to die at an earlier age. The team found that plant-based proteins were not as detrimental to health as animal-based proteins.
A new study sponsored by NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center has highlighted the prospect that global industrial civilization could collapse in coming decades due to unsustainable resource exploitation and increasingly unequal wealth distribution. It finds that according to the historical record, even advanced complex civilizations are susceptible to collapse, raising questions about the sustainability of modern civilization. The fall of the Roman Empire and the equally, if not more, advanced Han, Maruan and Gupta empires, as well as so many advanced Mesopotamian empires, are all testimony to the fact that advanced, sophisticated, complex and creative civilizations can be both fragile and impermanent. By investigating the human nature dynamics of these past cases of collapse, the project identifies the most salient interrelated factors which explain civilizational decline and which may help determine the risk of collapse today, namely population, climate, water, agriculture, and energy. These social phenomena have played a central role in the character in the process of the collapse in all such cases over the last 5,000 years.
Meanwhile, in a rare intervention into policy debate, the American Association for the Advancement of Scientists urged Americans to act swiftly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and lower the risks of leaving climate catastrophe for future generations. As scientists, it's not our role to tell people what they should do, but we consider it our responsibility as professionals to ensure to the best of our ability that people understand what we know. Human-caused climate change is happening. We face the risks of abrupt, unpredictable, and potentially irreversible changes, and responding now will lower the risks and costs of taking action.
Guy McPherson is Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology at the University of Arizona. His predictions are even more severe than those of NASA, and he believes that humans will imminently be declared extinct.
I left active service with the university about 5 years ago, and subsequently have focused primarily on research that deals with global climate change. And so in the last 5 years or so, I've spent a lot of time connecting the dots, collating, summarizing, synthesizing the information on climate change. But I also, I'm a conservation biologist, and I also spend quite a bit of time thinking, writing, studying various aspects of conservation biology, in particular what we're doing to the living planet.
Which problems have led you to believe that near-term extinction of humans is so likely?
Climate change has accelerated and continues to accelerate. There is no politically viable way to deal with climate change. And so we're just going to keep burning fossil fuels until we can't, apparently, until they're beyond our reach. And as a consequence, we have, it appears to me, we've locked in human extinction relatively near term, simply as a result of climate change. On the other hand, if we observe complete economic collapse at the planetary level, we might ward off climate change or at least slow down climate change, but then we'll trigger the catastrophic meltdown of the world's 400 and change nuclear power plants. That's going to be inconvenient for human beings, all that ionizing radiation we're suddenly bathing in. The third and also critical factor is what we're doing to every aspect of the living planet, with particular emphasis on the species that provide services for us, that we're driving to extinction at the rate of some 200 species a day.
But given all this, do you believe that human animals can ever live sustainably on Earth?
So for 2 million years, it appears we never once entered human population overshoot at the level of the globe. It appears that never once did we live so far outside of nature, so far beyond nature's reach, that we managed to destroy habitat for ourselves. Now we're doing it, and it's worse every day.
Yes, it's a very different culture that people are socialized into now. So what do you say to those who believe it's only capitalism that's the problem?
Well, I don't see any evidence of that. I think it's all of industrialized civilization. In China, and for a long time in the Soviet Union, they chased after something they didn't call capitalism. And they too were in human population overshoot. In fact, China is a great example. They instituted a one child policy, which they vigorously attempted to enforce. And during the generation or so of the one child policy, the Chinese population grew by somewhere around 30%. So it looks like that didn't work. If that doesn't work, I'm not sure what will. And most of the Chinese at the time would not have considered themselves pursuing industrial capitalism.
Yeah, it does seem that politics, even of the left, are no less reliant on industrialism and consumption.
Right, and we keep chasing the brass ring. Everybody wants what America has because we have all these conveniences. So apparently other people are going to keep chasing after that until it kills us.
Most governments at least pay lip service to the serious threat of climate change. Do you see any global possibility of turning this around?
No, I don't. We've triggered so many self-reinforcing feedback loops that it's difficult for me to imagine how we could turn the ship around. Timothy Garrett wrote a paper that was published in Climate Change, a premier journal in the field, in November 2009. It was published. And in that paper, he pointed out that only complete collapse prevents runaway climate change. Given that it's 40 years between emission of greenhouse gases and temperature rise. 40 years between cause and effect. Probably it was too late at the time Garrett wrote his paper, but subsequently the scientific community has documented 30 self-reinforcing feedback loops. Just one of those, the firing of the clathrate gun, that is methane leaking out of the Arctic Ocean at an accelerating rate, just an investigation of that one is enough to induce pretty significant fear in climate scientists everywhere. And that single event points to 4 degrees or so warming in 2030 and exponential warming beyond that. We haven't had humans on this planet at 3.5 degrees C above baseline, and we're headed for 4 degrees C in the not too distant future. I don't see how we retain habitat for humans in that way. In addition, since Garrett's paper was published, Clive Hamilton, in his April 2013 book, Earthmasters, points out that collapse of industrialization leads, within a matter of days, to a 1.1 degrees C warming above what we currently experience. Tack that onto the 0.85 we're at now relative to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and we're at 1.95 degrees C as a result of collapse. If only collapse prevents runaway climate change, and collapse takes us to 2 degrees C, 1.95. 2 degrees C is the political target people have been aiming at for a long time and trying to avoid. If collapse leads us there overnight, then not collapsing leads us there in the not too distant future as well. In fact, the International Energy Agency says we're headed there by 2017. It looks like a real double bind to me. If industrialization collapses, we go to 2 degrees C, and that triggers all kinds of catastrophic events. If industrialization doesn't collapse, we're headed for 2 degrees C, and that triggers all kinds of adverse consequences. I don't see a way out.
And regardless of the lip service, the governments were also overseeing rises in greenhouse gas emissions every year, weren't they?
There's just no politically viable response to climate change. To subscribe to Garrett's paper, only collapse prevents runaway climate change. I don't know any politician who would propose that and expect to be elected the next time around. So I just don't see any viable approach, political or otherwise. I see a lot of lip service, but I don't see any real attempts to deal with the issue. And it's a predicament. It's not a problem. It's a predicament. I don't see any governmental approach to dealing with it, because we need growth if we're going to sustain industrial civilization. And I don't know anybody in the industrialized world who thinks that growth is a bad idea. And growth for the sake of growth, the ideology of a cancer cell, as Edward Ebbing put it many years ago. I don't see anybody walking away from that to any great extent.
Hi, I'm Peter Vegan Power Ebden, former world snooker champion. And when I'm taking a break from making breaks, I tune into the Species Barrier radio show on Siren 107.3 FM.
Do you still believe that peak oil will sufficiently impact industrial civilization?
A Wall Street Advisor recently announced, without giving away his name, of course, that the United States is experiencing more than 30% unemployment rate. Actually, he said 37.2%. Well, I think that's because we're beyond the domain of inexpensive oil. So the official government figure here is 6.6%. A more likely figure is 37%. I think industrial civilization has fallen apart. And I think that's because of expensive oil, because we've run out of inexpensive oil. And so now we're in truly dire consequences with respect to industrial civilization being maintained. But it's too late for collapse to prevent runaway climate change. We've already triggered all those self-reinforcing feedback loops.
But you had thought that peak oil might be the trigger for humans living in a more sustainable way.
I was hoping that for a long time. I was wishing that industrial civilization would collapse in time to save our species. But the system being industrial civilization, has hung on so long that I just don't see humans persisting much longer because of climate change. So, yes, I thought we might be okay because of peak oil terminating industrial civilization, but that was a long time ago. The system has been churning along since then.
As dire as the situation isn't human extinction by 2030 a little dramatic? Won't we survive, but in vastly smaller numbers?
Well, I hope so. the difference between a few thousand individuals and none is infinite. So with a few thousand individuals, the persistence of our species, we have some prospect of a legacy. We have some ability for the species to sneak through the climate change bottleneck. I'd like to think that's the case, but I don't see it persisting with no habitat. And I strongly suspect when we get to 4C by 2030, that's going to happen so quickly that not only will we not have time to adapt, but the many organisms we depend upon for our own survival won't have time to adapt either. What's 4C mean? It almost certainly means the complete toxification of the oceans. That is, acidification so great that it just wipes out all or nearly all the phytoplankton in the ocean, mm-hmm. in all the world's oceans. Well, that's the base of the marine food web. That's roughly half the food we persist upon, the other half being land plants. Land plants are not going to react well to temperatures above 125 degrees Fahrenheit, above 45 or so degrees centigrade, because proteins begin to denature. If proteins denature on the plants, they're all going to die. In addition, there's not just warming, extreme warming that will trigger death of land plants. It's extreme cold as well. And so we have the meandering jet stream you might have heard about in the Northern Hemisphere, and particularly mm-hmm. in North America, which has caused, within two of the last 4 years, the death of many 80 to 100-year-old citrus trees in Tucson, Arizona, where I lived for a long time. It got so cold that it killed trees that are 80 to 100 years old. If extreme cold is killing a bunch of plants and extreme heat is killing a bunch of plants, I think that doesn't bode well, given that we're really just at the inflection point of exponential increase in temperatures.
What of those who say it's irresponsible to stop striving for solutions?
I guess I don't understand what you mean by solutions. If you're talking about solutions imposed, developed by and imposed by industrial civilization, which is the cause of the problem, I don't see civilization fixing itself. I promote the notion of economic collapse not to save our species, but to get as many species as possible through the bottleneck of industrial civilization. So from my perspective, that's a solution, and I have never given up on that solution. I have never proposed people walk away, give up on terminating this insane, omnicidal set of living arrangements.
So a solution of sorts would be hastening the collapse.
Right. And I recognize that that brings with it a rise to 2C in a matter of days, and that in the near term will lead to exceptional suffering on the part of human beings. But there's already exceptional suffering on the part of human beings, especially human beings who live in non-industrialized societies. And never mind the suffering we're bringing to the many species we're driving to extinction. Never minded that in the least before by the arrogance of humanism. But in addition, there's the 5 million people who die of climate change already. So there are already people dying, there are already people suffering, there are already other organisms suffering and not just dying, but winking out with respect to complete extinction. I don't know what people are looking for beyond the set of living arrangements, because we seem to be so addicted to the set of living arrangements.
You think they're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic?
Yes, absolutely. And that's been working so far. And also, to transfer wealth from the less wealthy to the extremely wealthy. And as nearly as I can tell, that's long been a goal of civilizations in general. And certainly industrial civilization is no different in that respect.
Should economists and GDP ever have been the judges and jury over the state of nations?
It's stunning to me that people subscribe to the notions of neoclassical economics, which are based on a series of assumptions underlain by sand, seeking economic growth at the expense of every aspect of the living planet is the very definition of insanity. We know that the economy is a subset of the environment, not the other way around. So what should be primary? Primary should be protecting the planet, protecting the living planet, the soils, the clean water, the clean air. That should be primary. Instead, what has become primary for us is pursuing money. that doesn't make a lot of sense to pursue colored pieces of paper when we know it's driving species to extinction at an accelerating rate. That doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Where can people find you?
You can find me at NatureBatsLast, and that's GuyMcPherson.com. I write frequently for an e-zine called Transition Voice, for the Good Men Project, and periodically for other outlets here and there. But all of that information is posted at NatureBatsLast at GuyMcPherson.com.
Hi, this is James Lightning Wilkes, vegan and winner of the Ultimate Fighter. You're listening to Barrier on Siren 107.3 FM.
Jonathan Porritt has warned that environmental charities such as Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace are failing to deal with human overpopulation. Writing for The Guardian, he recalled that 25 years ago, at the time of the Feed the World campaign, the population of Ethiopia was around 33 million. Today it's nearly 80 million, partly as a consequence of Western aid successfully preventing the death of millions of people who would otherwise not have survived periods of chronic drought. By 2050, on a business-as-usual projection, Ethiopia's population will be around 175 million, many of whom will be as vulnerable to serious drought as they were when we were all being exhorted to feed the world. To assert, as bluntly as some demographers do, that it is next to useless to go on pumping further aid into countries like Ethiopia until they have got on top of their unsustainable population growth is hateful to most development NGOs. Then bring it closer to home. In all the angst-ridden coverage of the recent floods in Somerset and the Thames Valley, did you hear a single representative of any of the UK's leading environmental organisations make the connection between the floods and the UK's still rising population? No, you didn't. Yet, they all know this is a key part of the story, and the UK's population is set to grow by around another 10 million people over the next 25 years. A significant percentage of those millions will end up housed in the southeast, further exacerbating already chronic overheating effects, including the need to build millions of new homes, many of which, despite the strangled complaints of the poor old environmental agency, will continue to be built on floodplains. The charity Population Matters, of which Jonathan is a patron, invited his friend Robin Maynard to conduct a survey where the eight leading NGOs in the UK are now positioned on population. Porritt described their responses on population issues as really rather pathetic.
Meanwhile, Ebbsfleet has been chosen as the location for a new UK city. Secretary of State for Communities Eric Pickles has previously reported that two new cities in the southeast will temporarily ease the ever-growing UK housing demands. The project will see an initial 15,000 homes built on the location. John Stewart was voted the number one environmental activist in the UK by the Independent newspaper. He has a history of protest against road building and aviation expansion. Hello, John, and welcome back to the Species Barrier. Last time we spoke to you about your opposition to air flight expansion, but it was really opposing London road expansion that was your focus initially, yes?
That's right. That started in the late 1980s when there were plans to build highways and motorways right across London. There is a problem, and there has been, for people who haven't got cars and who are trying to move around on foot and bicycles. There's a problem with our existing roads in that cars are often given priority. And when new roads are built, although these days the people who are building them say they will build in cycle lanes and so on, the purpose of the roads is for the cars. Pedestrians and cyclists are, at the very best, an added-on extra.
Seems to be a lot of proposals coming in for expanding the road networks. The Campaign for Rural England have expressed their concerns. How does the current situation compare to your experiences in the 80s and 90s?
I think the current situation is slightly different from the 80s and 90s. I think then, if there was a problem with traffic congestion, either in urban areas or rural areas, road building was seen as the first option. I think it's probably true to say that the protests in the 80s and the 90s ruled out road building as the first option, but clearly the fact that some roads are coming back now for consideration, it means that road building hasn't been ruled out altogether. It's not the first thing that policymakers go for, but it's still a solution in the back of their minds.
Which areas nationally were offered at least temporary protection as a result of the campaigns in the 80s and 90s?
The campaign in the 1980s was really exclusively on London because there was this £13 billion programme to build new roads and widen existing roads right across London. That campaign was successful and that all those road schemes were dropped. And I think what it has meant is that for London, new road building is virtually now off the agenda because politicians understand just how difficult it is politically to build new roads in somewhere like London. During the 1990s, it was a national road building scheme that was being opposed, including both urban and rural roads. A lot of those roads were defeated, so many cities were saved from being concreted over by roads, but also some rural areas. What I think is coming back now is more road building in rural areas rather than urban areas, because I think politicians are particularly worried about the strength of opposition that there might be in towns and cities.
With ever more people and ever more cars on the road, can the infrastructure continually bend to support such growth whilst preserving these areas in the longer term?
I think in the longer term, and indeed starting now, governments have got to look at the whole concept of traffic reduction. Because although road schemes have been defeated in the past, what really hasn't been tackled by governments is any realistic way to stop the remorseless growth in the amount of traffic. And if traffic continues to grow, then of course there'll be pressure for new roads. My view is that traffic reduction is possible by investment in good public transport, by investment where appropriate in safe cycling and walking facilities, and if need be, but possibly as a final resort, a form of road pricing, whether that be in cities or on motorways, so that using cars becomes more expensive than using public transport.
Did you have any views on the traffic reduction scheme put in by Paris recently?
I think the traffic reduction scheme put in by Paris in order to cut their air pollution levels was a little bit of a panic measure. It captured the headlines. It's dramatic if you're going to reduce significantly the amount of cars in a city like Paris. But I think what's really needed is longer-term measures. It's a proper strategic plan to find ways and to implement ways of reducing traffic over a period of years so that we don't need to see in the future panic measures like I think Paris introduced recently.
Out of all the possible battlefronts, what is your current environmental focus?
Well, my own focus is primarily still on opposing a third runway at Heathrow, but I am increasingly being drawn into the campaigns to oppose further road building, and particularly in London where I live, there are some significant campaigns building up to oppose, for example, a new tunnel under the Thames, a kind of parallel Blackwell tunnel, which we believe in the long term would just generate extra traffic rather than relieving congestion.
And what are you recommending as means of reducing car travel? Is it just investment in public transport and so on?
I think it's primarily that. I mean, I think in London, where car traffic is very high, actually is one of the easier places for traffic reduction policies to be implemented, because London has still got a good public transport system. It's got one of the best networks of bus services in the country, perhaps even in Europe. What I think we need to do is improve the rail, underground and buses yet further. We critically need to find ways of reducing fare levels in London. That's the big problem. That's one of the big disincentives for people using public transport. I think there are ways in which that can be done. For example, I'd be in favour of imposing a levy on the many banks that are in central London. That is where the money can be directed towards reducing fares for public transport. I think there's also we need to build on the measures to improve cycling and walking. An awful lot could be done.
Is the UK lagging behind other countries as regards its prices on public transport?
Yeah, UK is probably, across the country as a whole, the cost of public transport, I think, is still higher and considerably higher than any other European country. And some countries are considerably lower than in the UK. Wherever fares are reduced, wherever they're cheap, then people, particularly in cities, will use the trains, the tubes, the buses. The really big problem in London, and actually is although the public transport is better than it was for a long time, so many people just realistically can't afford to use it. And in other parts of the UK, the public transport in many cases is both poor and expensive.
On the subject of dangerous roads, here are the Smiths with There Is a Light That Never Goes Out.
Take me out tonight, where there's music and there's people and they're young and alive.
not one anymore. Take me out to my way, 'cause I want to see people and I want to see life. Driving in your car, oh please don't drop me home, because it's not my home, it's their home, and I'm welcome no more. If a double-decker bus crashes into us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. And if a ten-ton truck kills the both of us, to die by your side, well, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. Take a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't ask. Take me out tonight. Oh, take me anywhere where I'm clear, I'm clear, I'm clear. Driving in your car, I never, never want to go home, because I haven't got one.
David Jensen is author of books such as The Culture of Make-Believe and Endgame. He's co-founder of the Deep Green Resistance, and as that title suggests, he isn't ready to follow Guy McPherson's message in putting the Earth into a hospice just quite yet.
I'm the author of, I think, 22 books and bazillions of articles. My work is all about attempting to stop this culture from killing the planet.
What are your key foundations?
One of my key beliefs is that the real world is primary, and that we can have social theories, but the important thing is what's real. The important thing about what is real is that without a living planet, you don't survive. And we can tell ourselves whatever stories we want, but without water to drink, and without air to breathe, and without food, then you die. And you're an animal. And I'm an animal, and animals require habitat. We can tell ourselves all sorts of stories about what is important to us, and it's very clear what is important to us in this culture is money, power, sports, movies, but what is real is food, clothing, and shelter. Part of the reason that we don't defend the places that we live is that we have come to believe that it is the system that supports us as opposed to the real world that supports us. So if your experience, not even our beliefs, but if your experience is that your food comes from a grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you will end up defending to the death that system and the system that has the grocery store and the system that has the water tap, because your life depends on it. And if, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, then you will defend to the death those because your life depends on that. And one of the reasons that we're so crazy is that the system has systematically inserted itself in between us and the real world. And that's intentional, not to say it's a conspiracy. It's like a friend of mine says that you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. But that's intentional on the part of those in power. This is one reason that indigenous peoples have been systematically forced off their land, is that how do you make them dependent upon the system? How do you force them into the wage economy? And we've seen this time and again. That was one of the reasons for the laws of apartheid in South Africa, was that they needed people to work in the mines, and no sane person goes and works underground unless either you have to or you'll die or getting paid a lot of money or you are a slave. And the people in South Africa were not working in the mines, and so they would pass hut taxes and poll taxes and dog taxes, all sorts of taxes to force people who were living in subsistence economies into the wage economy. How are you going to get money? You got to get a job. Very simple. If you have a lot of land and not many people on it, then that means that people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter. But if, on the other hand, you have a lot of people, and then if that's the case, the only way you can get them to work for you is the point of a gun. You can't allow them to have access to that land, which means you can't allow them to have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means either you enslave them physically or you get them to all believe that Weyerhaeuser or Burlington Northern or Northern Pacific or Sierra Pacific own all the land and they have to stay off it. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, people don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they have to go to work for you for whatever pittance you want to give them. You know, you asked what was one of my beliefs. One of my beliefs is that the real world is real and this culture is killing it. But I guess I'd like to back up for a second and talk about three themes that run through a lot of my work. And to do that, I want to talk about three of my earlier books. And the first one that I want to mention is my book, A Language All in a Word. And in that, one of the central ideas of that book is that the problems that we face are not fundamentally rational. And therefore, they're not really amenable to rational solution, a reasonable solution. And what I mean by this is that this culture is insane in its system of what it values. And one of the ways I talk about this is that during the American football season, there are 100,000 people who attend every single University of Michigan Wolverines football game. And in 2002, I believe it was about 10 years ago, whenever, there was a single Wolverine sighted in Michigan. It was the first real Wolverine in 200 years. And it lived there a few years and then died. And my point is that there are more people who care about the Michigan Wolverines than they care about real Wolverines. And that's nuts. And another way to say all this is that in A Language Old in Words, I'll back up again, in A Language Old in Words, I talk about, the book was originally supposed to be about interspecies communication and how we have sort of, there's a split between public and private discourse about interspecies communication, that most of us in private will say that we have conversations with non-humans all the time. We have conversations with our dogs, with our cats. We have communications with them. We understand each other. We have conversations with plants. This is all just routine in our daily conversation, in our daily lives. But when it comes to our public discourse, then we can't talk about this because it'll seem like we're crazy. And we can't talk about humans not being particularly special. I'm writing a book right now about human supremacism and how I think that's one of the biggest problems facing the planet today, is this belief that humans are fundamentally special. And so I was going to write a book about that, and just a book about how we all have these experiences of interspecies communication. And then I realized really early on that I couldn't write that book for a couple of reasons. One is that because it was going to be this happy book about all these happy conversations, and I realized that any book that is about interspecies relations and is happy would be a lie, because this culture is killing the planet. Terrible atrocities against non-humans, whether we are talking about these non-humans as animals or plants or fungi or bacteria or rivers or stone. I mean, for crying out loud, this culture has bombed the moon. So this is all really important, because so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really is. Another way to say this is that humans perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited. How you perceive the world affects how you behave. And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. And the same is true for women. And this is absolutely crucial to how this culture is killing the planet, by perceiving the world as consisting of resources to be exploited. And I realized really early on that I wasn't so interested in writing this book about purporting to show that non-humans really can think, because to do so would not challenge the underlying bigotry of this culture. To do so would be like writing a book that purports to show that blondes can think, or writing a book that purports to show that Jews really aren't subhuman. Really what I wanted to write was a book about why it is that some of us are willing to listen and some of us can listen. And some of us are either unwilling or unable to listen. And really, that theme runs through all of my work since then. So the first book was about interspecies communication, and kind of about child abuse, and kind of about the atrocities perpetrated by this culture. And really the central theme, or the central idea of that book, the thesis of that book, is that we have an entire culture that is suffering from what Judith Herrmann would call complex post-traumatic stress disorder. By which I mean that we have an entire culture that has been so traumatized that it's not really capable of participating in relationships. And this is really what patriarchy does to everyone. And so that's the language of the words. I talk about how this culture is really psychologically messed up and irredeemable. And then my book, The Culture of Make-Believe, was supposed to be a 5-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And I asked the question, what is a hate group? And the book exploded. In that book, what I eventually get to is that if you have a social reward system that is based on competition, that will set people against each other. And so, really, a social reward system that's based on competition leads inevitably to hatred and atrocity.
Humans are both selfish and social. And so what they do is they collapse the selfishness-altruism dichotomy by praising. They recognize that we're social creatures, and we reward what we get praised for. We do what we get praised for. This is Behavior Mod 101. And so what they do is they socially reward behavior that benefits the group as a whole, and they disallow behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. And on the other hand, the bad cultures are the ones that reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group, in which case you end up with competition and a dog-eat-dog society. Don't you just love that phrase? So what this means is that basically we have a culture that has a social reward system that is entirely the wrong direction. We all know wealth and power go together.
Wellness salute. This is Dick Man from Dan Prez, shouting out 107.3 FM. You are listening to The Species Barrier. Rise up.
A language older than words, the central thesis is that this culture is psychologically aimed toward destruction, toward destroying the planet. And then Culture Make-Believe was about how this culture, the social reward system of this culture, is really destructive. And then when I wrote my book Endgame, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know, you can argue with psychology, and you can argue with social reward systems, but you can't argue with the movement of resources. So in that book, I define civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities.
And civilizations from the beginning have been characterized by cities. But what's a city? So a city I define as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. This is really key, that they require the importation of resources, because the city has denuded the land base of whatever resource it now needs to import. And as the city gets larger, it will denude an ever larger area. And this is not sustainable. The only way of living that would be sustainable
would be to live within what the land gives willingly. The accounts of how extraordinarily rich this world was before this culture are just stunning and heartbreaking. There were whales in the Mediterranean. There were hippos on the Thames. Did you know that?
No.
Well, here in the UK, obviously, we had bears and wolves, but that's just a totally distant memory now.
Yeah. And there were hippos. Hippos were taken out prior to the arrival of the Romans, really. It was with the beginning of agriculture, which has been a disaster for the planet everywhere. In the United States, there were passenger pigeons in flocks so large they darkened the sky for days at a time. The whales were so thick that they were a hazard to shipping. They were so thick that it always looked like it was foggy off Cape Cod because so many whales are blowing. The spools of fish were so thick that they would slow ships down. The forests were so thick and so rich that you could smell them for miles out to sea. The rivers, the runs of salmon were so thick that the Indians in this region would sometimes throw a pebble into a stream to count how long it would take for the pebble to hit the bottom of the stream because the salmon were so thick that the pebble couldn't make its way between their body. And they were so thick that you could hear them for miles before you'd see them. There was a run of salmon in the early 1930s. So this is after they've been hammered a lot. In the early 1930s, there was a run of salmon up in Alaska that was 12 miles wide and ran for 38 days. This is what you see over and over and over. And how did the world get to be so rich in the first place? The way it got to be so rich was by every creature simply living and dying and making the habitat better by its very life. That's what salmon do. They make the land base better by their lives and death. And that's what bears do. That's when the early European explorers got here, the place is a paradise. And the Europeans have been here for 180 years now, and the place is trash. And, I mean, when they have salmon spawning tours now, people are really happy when they see two or three or four salmon spawning as opposed to the entire river being full of them. It is possible to live in a place without destroying it. It is not possible to have a city without destroying the place. Cities require colonies. They have from the beginning. And the colonizers are very, very aware of this. And it's ridiculous for us to pretend that it's not the case. And there are functional, systematic problems with this way of living. I mean, one of the jokes that I've told for a long time is they say that one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. I'm going to lay out a pattern, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And what this is one of the earliest written myths of the dominant culture is Gilgamesh. And Gilgamesh deforested the hillsides and plains of Iraq. When you first think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of is cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? That's what Iraq was. That's what the whole Fertile Crescent was. Beautiful cedar forest. And he cut them down to make a city, which, of course, is the story of this entire culture. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna that exported timber up to Babylon. And the Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. The Greek philosophers were complaining that deforestation was harming water quality in Greece. And I am reasonably certain that the Greek Department of Environmental Quality told them that they need to study this for a few years and make sure there's really a correlation, which is still what they're saying today. Italy was heavily forested. Europe was heavily forested. The UK was heavily forested. And that's what this culture does. I mean, it's what we see with this culture is there were elephants in China. They had pink tusks and they were killed by agriculture. And we don't see this pattern. So really Endgame is about this, seeing this larger pattern, because I have a doctor friend who says the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. How can you figure out what to do? I started having some chest pain back in December, and I didn't have insurance at that point, which is something that probably makes no sense to your UK ears. And so I didn't get a test right away. So I was presuming it was, I was hoping it was heartburn. So I was doing all sorts of stuff to figure out whether it was heartburn. And then because of Obamacare, I got some health care and I went in and it ends up it is my heart. And the point here is that if you have the wrong diagnosis, it doesn't matter how carefully you follow the cure. It's not going to help. And if we presume that the problem is that we're using fossil fuels instead of, actually not fossil fuels, that's not what they are, because they're not really fuels. What they are is it's oil. You know, it's not a resource. It is been converted into a resource perceptually. Anyway, if your way of life is based on burning oil, that's not just the problem. The problem is it's based on non-renewable resources and the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources. That's a much bigger problem than it just being oil. And you're going to have different solutions if you see that as a problem.
You said your upcoming book will cover human supremacy. Have your thoughts and themes evolved over the course of your writing?
Well, I think they've evolved. So I did an interview of Neil Emerdon years and years ago. He's fabulous. He's fabulous. He wrote this great book called The Natural Alien. And part of his point is that it's really harmful to draw the line between humans and non-humans and subjective humans who are important and non-humans who are not important. And one of the things I said to him was, so where do you draw the line then? And he looked at me and said, why do you have to draw the line at all between who is important and who is not? And that was such a wonderful homecoming for me when he said that to me. And so really my work has been about becoming more courageous in talking about what is really clear to me, which is that the world consists of all of these glorious subjects who are living their own lives that are just as valuable to them and important to them as my life is to me. All of these are sentient. All of these have lives that are important and meaningful to them, but they are just as important as I am. And they love their own lives just as much as I love mine. My movement in this has been in becoming more confident in talking about this and also in just gaining more information. If you've read Endgame, if you can be reading through part of it, there gets to be a part where the tone of that book suddenly changes. And part of the reason for that change is because I've always known that this culture is pretty irredeemable. Like, I completely got it in my gut, and I completely lost patience with this culture. You know, it's pretty interesting. The central metaphor of my work is death and rebirth. And a lot of people have said that my books can be very difficult to read, but then life-changing if they do. And they'll read some of the book and then they have to put them away, and then they read more of the book and then they put it away. And that's really intentional on my part, because what I'm attempting to do with my book, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what I'm attempting to do is to destroy our colonized selves, to destroy our socially created self, so that we can then remember that we are human animals who need habitat. And one of the ways I talk about this is in the 1980s was the first time that the corporate press started consistently referring to human beings as consumers more often than citizens. And this is really important, because if you perceive yourself as a consumer, basically your options for resistance are buy and don't buy. You can vote with your dollars or you can not vote with your dollars. But if you're a citizen, you can buy or not buy, you can organize, you can rally, you can protest, you can, as the Declaration of Independence says, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. So as a citizen, you can rebel. And then also, there's another transformation that happened several thousand years ago, which is when we went from being human animals who need habitat, who enter into a compact with the state where the state takes care of us, and in exchange we give the state a monopoly on violence. And my point with my work is I'm attempting to peel back those layers of enculturation to get us back to remembering that we're human animals who need habitat and who have families. I will ask people at my talk, how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? And civilization is killing me. I have Crohn's disease, which has led to these heart problems and led to all sorts of other problems. Crohn's disease is a disease of civilization. It's a disease of industrialization. And it's literally killing us, and yet we still don't resist. And so I'm trying to peel back those layers. And what happens in the middle of Endgame is I think I finally got those layers peeled back pretty well for me. And of course, it's a continual process, and it goes on forever. I finally myself hit bottom and, like, lost patience with attempting to make sense of this culture and instead attempting to stop it.
Fact of the day, Derek Jensen is critical of agriculture, as is Jared Diamond. Whilst the Amazon is undoubtedly being cleared in order to farm soya and cattle, the soya production is again tied largely to animal agriculture. About 85% of the world's soybeans are processed or crushed annually into soybean meal and oil. Approximately 98% of the soybean meal that is crushed is further processed into animal feed, with the balance used to make soy flour and proteins. You can find us at veganoutreachuk.blogspot.com. You can also find us on Facebook under The Species Barrier. You can email us, thespeciesbarrier@gmail.com. And you can find us on Twitter, Species Barrier. We are now on iTunes, and you just type in The Species Barrier. Please leave us reviews. We'd really appreciate it. It helps us get up the listings. It means that more people can find us. We're now on iTunes. You can find us at The Species Barrier. Please subscribe. And if you'd be so kind, please leave reviews, because it really helps. And if you don't want to use iTunes, you can always find us on archive.org.